Hey, welcome back to Community in Code. My name is Chris Reynolds, and my guest today will tell you in the most Canadian way possible that he's not really that technical. But if you let him show you the complex architecture diagrams that he's built to illustrate the FAIR project that he sits on the technical steering committee for, you'll probably have a hard time actually believing him. Brent Todorash is a Winnipeg-based developer, consultant, thinker of things, who's been in the WordPress community since it was B2. I've gotten a chance to meet him through the Federated and Independent Repositories, or FAIR, project, and in person last year at WordCamp Canada in Ottawa. He co-runs a WordPress-focused agency with his brother Scott, and came up through the 90s Linux and free software scene long before he ever touched WordPress, which he says is exactly backwards of most of the community. He thinks money is a lousy motivator, and that AI might actually bring back one of the oldest open source instincts, building a thing and giving it away. We talk about FAIR's evolution and adoption by Typo3, and how it was never really about WordPress, it was about the software supply chain itself. I'm thrilled to introduce you to Brent Todorash. Welcome to Community in Code, the podcast where we talk to the human beings behind the commits. Today, I am with Brent Todorash, a longtime WordPress user, developer, thinker of things, and currently, basically, you're kind of project managing the FAIR project, I think is safe to say. Welcome to the show, Brent. Tell us about yourself.
It's a big subject because I'm not a young guy anymore. I've been in the WordPress space for many years, low profile for most of that time, but more recently I've kind of stepped up to work with Aspire Press and then with FAIR, and kind of become associated there as well. I don't have a formal designation or title as the project manager of FAIR, but I just kind of step in with that kind of sort of thinking and thought process, and rather than pure code, is kind of help out, which is cool because open source is always bring the skills you have, and if coding is not at the top of your list, that's okay. There's still things you can do.
I feel like you're being very humble because I've seen some of the architecture diagrams that you have drawn up, and they are highly technical and things that require me to squint my eyes a little bit to follow the logic. So there's a lot of thinking that goes in there, and there's a lot of pulling pieces together, and FAIR as a project is a complex beast, let's say.
Yes. Yeah. Humble, whatever. I'm Canadian. We're generally self-deprecating as a rule. So if I downplay myself, it's cultural. I've created some very complicated diagrams, and as the saying goes, any fool can make something complicated, but the real, so that's what I do. I make things complicated, but really, FAIR has a lot of moving pieces and a lot of, very intricate bits. And most people don't look at it as a whole because it's very hard to do that. So we kind of look at it in little pieces. So you've probably seen the diagram with everything on it, mm-hmm. but in practice, you really look at that in just chunks because it's easier to conceptualize what each system does that way. Mm-hmm. And the big diagram is how the systems interrelate and talk to each other. So but that's kind of one of the things that I've sort of done over the years is, it's what I do. I pull at threads, and either I've discovered they're disconnected and should be thrown away, or I find out how it really does connect things, and how things need to talk to each other if they aren't, or what, that sort of thing. So that's sort of the big picture or systems thinking that I kind of really excites me. And this is one of the reasons, going back to open source, this is one of the classic reasons why people do it at all, is because, you know, offer someone an interesting problem and they'll show up. Mm-hmm. And that was my introduction to open source, is late 90s, I started reading and started playing with Linux and stuff like that, and learning more about the open source development model and about free software, and that is a big question, because you typically think of, or it's changing, thankfully, but for a long time you thought about software as something that, you know, how can I make money from this? It's how, I'm gonna write some code and then I need to cash in. But historically, that wasn't the view. It was historically, it was, I'm writing code. This is interesting. Maybe somebody else can use it. I'll just share it, and they'll share stuff with me. And that's how, that's how computer science generally, is standing on the shoulders of giants, which is a whole scientific model of sharing, because everyone benefits. So, I forget where I was going, but
well, that tangents into sort of where I wanted to go anyway, which is sort of what brought you to, what got you interested in tech to begin with, what sort of led you into the realm of open source software.
Let's see, what got me into tech? High school for me was the early 80s. So when I got to high school, we had computer science courses. I signed up for all of them, all the computer science, all of the data processing, everything we could do, and found out I just really liked it. And it turned out I was reasonably good at it. So at that time we were using punch cards and feeding them into the card reader, and it was a whole production. So my first programs I ever wrote were like pencil and paper, which you then copy onto the cards. So it was I just took to it. I really liked it. The school had these Commodore PET, which is just like a larger Commodore 64 that people would be familiar with. But these started out with 32K of memory. I used all of it. I wrote a program one time where I actually had to go and change the wording of some of the display sentences to make them shorter, because I'd run out of memory and I just had to squeeze it in. But that was my introduction to tech. But I didn't follow it up. So after high school, I just did other things. So I didn't, and regretted it later. I should have stuck with it, gone to university and learned to do it properly. But I was in the general insurance industry for about a dozen years, and had a professional designation as a insurance broker and analyzing risk and all that stuff, which came in handy later. But as of it was spring of 2000. I'd been, I'd gotten online by then and was, back into the computers and was learning more about open source and all that stuff as the internet was becoming popular. So spring of 2000, I went into business with my brother. So we were partners and built an ISP, wireless ISP. We did hosting. We did software development. So he came from a client server development in the 90s. They were doing a lot of some very large software work. So he actually did go to he did get an education in writing software, and I just picked up the web stuff as I got into it. So we started doing that in early 2000, and we survived Y2K. So a lot of people who listen to your podcast, this is before their time anyway. I don't know. At least they may not remember it. Maybe too young to remember. So, and it's interesting to think that now it's over 25 years, where open source has been maturing and I would say winning the day, because, what's the stat? It's a huge percentage of even commercial packages that have open source somewhere embedded in them that are relying on it. Microsoft, who called Linux an existential threat, is on the Linux bandwagon now. And it's been a wild ride.
So. Yeah, no, I was actually going to say, because, talking about Linux in the 90s and open source in the 90s, that was really sort of like, the enemy of the state sort of thing. Like, Microsoft was huge. Apple was slightly less so, actually considerably less so in the 90s. Yeah. It was very much like seen as a threat to the whole operational model of these large tech companies to even consider giving something away for free. What attracted you? Like, what about that model was made it attractive to you to play with Linux as opposed to like the sort of dogma of the time from Microsoft is saying like, no, don't do this. This is very bad. Use our stuff instead.
Yeah. That's a good question. I've always been one of these root for the underdog kind of guys. So, so that kind of helps. Voting for not Microsoft would have been a thing. I like Bill Gates a lot more since he left Microsoft. I objected to the way that Microsoft used their monopoly in Explorer, Internet Explorer, and then in even the Office suite, like all of that stuff, that embrace, extend, extinguish, and fight everything with FUD. So I kind of reacted to that and wanted to find another way. I liked the sort of mutual sharing, and we don't have to be in this for the money. As long as everybody has enough to get on with their life, that's, we don't have to, see who's got the biggest stack of coins. That's never been the biggest motivator for me. And I don't think it is. People might criticize the viewpoint, but I don't think money is a good long-term motivator. Mm. I think it's a fair short-term motivator. You'll show up and get paid all week, but whatever they offer you as a staggering salary, 3 years in, it doesn't matter anymore. It's if the job is drudgery, you'll still hate it, right? So, right. So there's things that money just doesn't overcome in motivation, but in In software, in open source, it's interesting problems. It's scratching that personal itch is always the classic metaphor that, you know, I need to do this. And so you write the thing and you do it, and then you just give it away. And this is actually something that I think AI can help us regain that mindset, because when it becomes easy to write that kind of stuff, you can write what you need as you need it and then give it away, because somebody else could write it just as easily, and it the software doesn't have a value. So there's a lot of concern, and rightly so, about devaluation of software, or of the time that software developers put in. And I share that concern, but if there's a silver lining, it would be the recovery of this ideal that it's okay to share. So,
I just wrote a blog post today because I was thinking about the fact that I don't miss not writing code, and that realization comes along with the realization that, like, it wasn't the writing code part that I liked as much as the building things part. And if Claude can write code faster and probably better than I can, which I think it can now, I am less concerned. I feel less loss by not writing the actual functions into my IDE, as much as I would feel loss about not actually being able to build a thing that scratches my own itch or solves a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've built some interesting things, like, very recently, because I was looking at Invert, is that what you called it? Mm-hmm. And I thought, I like this, because it sort of crossed my path about 3 days after I had been spending time with my buddy Claude, and we were chatting, as we do, designing a system where because I thought everybody's going to Astro Plus fill in the blank for, you know, I've moved my WordPress site from, you know, to Astro Plus something. And I thought, well, this is kind of fun. I could write blog posts using VI on the command line, and then talk about distraction free. There's nothing to click. You just type. If you can recover that, but also have the ability to sort of edit any way you want. I started thinking, well, okay, so I'm using Obsidian. Maybe I've got something in Obsidian that I just want to push to my website, or I just want to quickly log in and, you know, do something. And I just have a command line, or maybe I'm in my browser and I want to do something in the browser. What if I wanted to update my blog using any one or all of those methods? And so this is the conversation I was having with Claude, is, okay, how do we build that? And sort of stitching it together so that, okay, well, we'll store everything as Markdown. And then even if you're using headless WordPress or doesn't matter, we have a way of just kind of merging all the content together, store it all in Git, and then build a site with it. And then Invert came up, and I thought, wait a minute. So I said, So I pointed Claude at it and said, take a look at this and take a look at what we designed and tell me, you know, where they the same, where they different. And he just went through it and said, this is very, you know, very much on the same page as what you were doing. So we hit a similar itch, and independently we could sit down and use Claude, and I think that's I think you're right. It's something you don't have to write all of the lines of code anymore, but it's still important to understand the task. And this is what I've been telling people recently about AI, is Yes, it's great. AI is something you leverage. It's not something you just delegate to.
Yeah.
Because you can't just say, oh, go do everything. You have to leverage it to do tasks. And if you don't understand the task, you can't create a prompt. So in building software, if I can build the prompt and if I can understand the use case and understand the architecture and the approach, I don't have to remember the wording of every individual function. Because, so I don't have to look it up as to, you know. So that saves a lot of time. But I was doing a proposal for a client this week, and I was like, okay, well, I haven't done this yet, but let's try it. So I gave all the information to Claude and said, you know, create an estimate for this. This is what we want to build. Create an estimate. And it came back, and here's, and it estimated way higher than I did. So, but that aside, I said, okay, now, because it's estimating as if you just put a couple of developers on the task, and right. I said, now, what if we have you do all the parts that, you know, that you can do better and more efficiently, or whatever. I forget how I worded it, but you know what I asked. It's all right, great, but what if we have you do a bunch of it? And the saving was 40%, mm-hmm. which is a lot less than the hype would have you believe.
Sure.
And I think that's the lesson, is that you still have to understand what you're doing. You can't just, you know, feed in and
yeah. It makes me think about like sort of a fundamental rule of software development, or even just of using computers, which is that the computer is only as good as you made it, or like it only knows what you told it to do. It can't do things that you didn't tell it to do specifically. And as smart, in quotations, as AI is, it still follows that same rule. And so like, I think about like things like OpenClaw, and like the things that the weird stuff and the weird problems that come about from OpenClaw agents doing their own stuff and sort of like managing their own soul files and whatever, like that largely comes down to the original instructions given to that agent being not clear or specific enough for it to that, which then allows it to sort of go off the rails because you never told me not to do this. And so I'm going to like, you know, develop a weird personality, or like, you know, go off and start writing takedown articles about open source maintainers, or I'm going to, you know, like,
yeah,
like all sorts of things, because like it was just left so open-ended, and that's like you said, like, you use the tool. If you don't use the tool, then I mean, in those cases, the tool ends up using you, or goes off, like goes rogue and does like weird stuff.
Yeah, you've got to give it the guidelines, and if you don't, it's just going to wander aimlessly. I was listening to a couple of podcasts on AI recently, because I went last week and picked up a refurbished PC, which is a fresh Linux install, and I just have to configure OpenClaw on it, and that's we're going to start playing with that. But so I've been listening to some of these podcasts, and I'm kind of losing my train of thought, but I forget where I was going. That's why I need an AI assistant. But
there you go.
But yes, you have to give it guidelines, and you have to kind of tell it what's expected, and tell it what to do and what not to do, and all of that. And this is sort of what I'm getting out of some of these this podcast, is people are saying that, or they're learning that in different ways. You know, how to configure it to get the most out of it, and so that's kind of what I'm um, what I'm about and with AI. I'm still getting the hang of it. It took me a long time to actually pull out my credit card for Claude, because I was doing the free, and so it's like, okay, well, we'll get 20 minutes of Claude every day or something. And but you know, then I got into more complex stuff and pull out the credit card and just did the very minimum, like $30 a month or whatever it is, and world of difference, just being able to access different models and you know, spend a couple of hours coming up with something with all of the back and forth that helps you dial in a design. And that's one thing that I found Claude is really good at. Is, you know, designing the system. We're able to, you know, go back and forth, and we come up with a really good project plan at the end, and then building it is a separate thing, but it becomes well defined. And turns out, who knew, it helps when you define your software ahead of time.
Really? Yeah.
What? You know, nobody's been saying that since the 80s, 90s, whatever. But yeah, it turns out that this is true for AI as much as it was for humans. And oh, that's what I was going to say about these podcasts is they're talking about treating the AI agent like you would an employee. And it feels a little weird, but like, right, you know, it sounds weird when you like, when if you're just talking to it or whatever, it they respond like a person, so it feels a little more natural. But conceptually, it seems weird that you would do that. But with an employee, if you don't give them good instructions, they can't succeed in what they're doing.
Right.
And it's exactly the same. So if you suck at that, you're going to suck at this.
You talked about going into business with your brother, and your brother went to school and got a degree, presumably in like software engineering or computer science. And you did not. And I know a lot of people have found their way into open source, included, in a more choose your own adventure path, and yes, with no sort of formalized education. Talk about some of the things, I guess, that you noticed or that were like both sort of the pros and cons, I think, of like you're directly interfacing with somebody who has this computer science background and you don't, but I think there's benefits on both sides, right?
So it was very different because I started building for the web. So late 90s, my brother said, someday all software is going to be delivered on the internet. So makes sense to get into the internet space. So it was pretty early on the curve. Because we were still doing dial up, you know, at that time. But it's true. That's how we expect software to work now. It's not the exception anymore. So, I mean, I still have desktop applications that I like, but, you can run your whole world in a browser now. So that is what's happened. But so he had a disciplined view of building software, and had worked on some very large projects. It was all, like I say, it was client server, it was object oriented stuff. So when I started messing around with HTML, that's much, much more basic. But he looked at what I was building and said, well, you know, that's really good attention to detail. And so we were able to kind of work together on building website stuff and sort of scoping things that we would do for a client. That's a lot of sort of business analysis and all that traditional stuff that you know, software projects used to involve. And we're actually coming back around to that because when we talk about a website project with with a lot of our clients now, it's not a like a brochureware kind of a thing that's just here's some static blurbs about whatever, come see us, pick up the phone. It because people now expect to be able to interact with you on the website, expect to either buy something or book something or order something, or you know, if you're in the market for a new car, you expect to go to the website and build it piece by piece and get a price at the end, and then you go to the dealer and you do all the things. But you know, at that point, by the time you get to the dealer, you probably know more about the vehicle than they do. So or you know, other products are the same because people are they're expecting that level of engagement. So you know, if you pay your water bill or your electric bill, that's all online. What did I pay 3 months ago? It's there, right? You know, what did I buy from Amazon last year? I want to buy it again. That was good. So it's all there. And that's what people expect. So we're doing those sorts of sort of analysis bits with clients now, the way that it used to be done when you're writing custom software for them to run their business. And we have clients that run their business online that have some very specific needs. We have one client that we're doing geospatial mapping using, you know, GIS mapping data, and it's an agricultural app. So they tell farmers what to put on, what fertilizer to put on the crop and in what part of the field. And then it's all GPS, so that when the farmer drives his equipment over a certain part of the field, it knows, adjust. And but we have it set up, they can do all of this online in a portal, because so they can do it in the field, they can do it from home, they can, because that's how we do software now. So yeah, that's so that's kind of where we came to, from, you know, me learning HTML and CSS, and my brother Scott having had sort of the education in, well, first you do the business analysis, then you write the thing, and then you do the software. And so I remember in the this must have been 2001-ish, 2002 maybe. We're writing an RFP response, and it said, describe your methodology. And this was, everybody was using waterfall and all this stuff. And we didn't like it. He didn't like it. I'd never tried to use it. So, cause I was just building websites, you know, but so we wrote our own methodology. Was 4 points. This is what you do. This is how you build software. And it was practical. It was, you could iterate on it. You could, and it worked very well. And you could even adapt it to use with other frameworks. And then, later on, everybody started talking about agile, and I looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is that. So, and within a few months of when the agile manifesto was literally created in a ski chalet or whatever, we were writing this thing, and it was all value-based. This is values, you know, this is how you approach the thing, rather than these are the exact perfect steps to do. It's no, this is the approach. These are the fundamental principles, stick with this and it'll work. So he had the my brother had the experience of working in large companies and red tape and all of that, and I'd spent my whole career working with small business, so it was another thing that we were very different in our experience. But it worked very well together, because we were able to say, okay, how can we make an enterprise approach work for small business? And that's one of the reasons we got into open source. We built a business that we couldn't have built without open source, because just the software licensing costs alone, but the ability to just install things, run them, say no, that's not the right thing, you'll switch to a different one or whatever it was. So we're able to build our business and also be able to share those approaches with clients. So we didn't need a custom built proprietary CMS. We had one. So back then I started using a little known blogging software called B2. And I went to install it one day and went back and said, this hasn't been updated for a while. And I was kind of reading and I was doing a new install and reading it. Oh, there's a couple of forks. And so I installed all three of them and played around. And yeah, that's how I got to WordPress. And I got to B2 because open source was a requirement. So I came to WordPress from open source rather than learning open source from WordPress involvement. And I noticed a little bit of a difference in a lot of the WordPress community who did not have an open source background before coming to it, which Matt's been very vocal about, you know, GPL support and all that, and that's been great. And it's been good to help spread that word. It's been a good introduction. I think people need to look farther than just WordPress to really understand open source. So that's my appeal to the WordPress community is, you know, look around more. So I've been running a Linux desktop for over two decades because it's open source. And if you know, I have an Android phone, I may not be totally at peace with the Google, but at least it's open source. Mm-hmm. that becomes sort of a default choice is if it's available, pick that first, unless there's a compelling reason, you know, for a different solution. So I know everybody loves the MacBooks, but in its core, you know, it's got the BSD.
Yep. Yep.
Roots. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That actually is the open source thing and being able to take something and then try it out and then choose something else. Like I also see the overlap with that and the AI conversation and some stuff that I've been reading lately has been, you know, to the extent of like, well, I've heard the question asked, how does open source exist in the world of AI? And I think that is one of those ways where like it becomes easier to build the thing, it becomes easier to have your little pet project or side project thing. And that also means that it's easier to take something that somebody else built and then tweak it, like you were saying about Invert, to be the thing that works for you. So, like I didn't build a connector yet for Obsidian, but like you could then take the code that I wrote or that Claude wrote, that I directed Claude to write and be like, hey, how do we make a connector for Obsidian for this thing so that I can publish from Obsidian? And then that can become part of the source code. That could just be part of what you're using it for. Yeah. And I think that that's I think there is a future. I think that is a really interesting future because like it lowers the barrier to entry to building new and interesting stuff.
Yeah. So, when I read The Cathedral and the Bazaar, the book, like late 90s, early 2000s, whatever it was, one of the rules is write one to throw away. You will anyhow. And this it feels like it's going to be really expensive to get deep into a project and then abandon it and start over. But with AI, that equation has just changed like drastically. And in a sense, you see this with MDASH recently, where, you know, you take 20 years of software development in WordPress and say, well, what if we did that today? And 2 months later, you know, sure, it's rough around the edges. Of course, it's that new. But, you know, this is what happens when you say, okay, well, let's take everything we've learned and do a redesign. And we've had to do that with some clients where, you know, in some cases they've been using software for years and we just say, okay, it's time to rewrite this thing because we don't want to support PHP 4.3 anymore, whatever, something crazy. In 2001, we bought a local agency. We're after the hosting clients because we were growing our hosting business, and we went and he said, "Well, I'll sell it to you, but you got to take the whole thing. You got to take the agency work as well." So we inherited like 96 or something, 90 some Cold Fusion sites, and it was like, we don't want to deal with Cold Fusion anymore. So it's great. That's almost 100 projects we get to. And so we started working through those conversions, and some of them were custom apps. Some of them were just very, very simple websites, but some were custom apps that we said, okay, it's time. This is really technical debt that you're paying. And we're going to rebuild it. So, we just got the last of them done, last summer. So, and it's live now and we're building on top of it. But yeah, that makes it feel like, okay, you did this prototype and you've got all of this effort into it. With AI, you can actually, you don't have that same, opportunity cost, no, sunk cost fallacy. That's it. Because people commit to the wrong path because they're very invested in it by now. And they don't see how advantageous it could be to get off it, even if it means kind of going back to the beginning. It's always faster to do something a second time. But AI can help us sort of break out of that sunk cost fallacy for software. And actually, just thinking of this now, it can help you find and address technical debt in existing code bases. Mm-hmm. If the hackers and crackers are using AI to find security vulnerabilities, we can do the same, patch those, but also, you know, what could be more efficient? I was writing some stuff for FAIR recently. It was shell scripts for some stuff that we're doing. And I was able to, after a certain number of iterations, was able to say, okay, well, we're going to run these three things in parallel rather than sequentially. And we're able to optimize kind of how the thing all works together. And that's just that back and forth that you kind of, that's not how you initially approach AI. Is you think you're just going to say, I need this and it'll produce it. But that AI and the back and forth with the AI and the ability to look at what you've got and figure where you're going and say, well, how can we do this better and keep iterating on it? You can do those iterations so much faster now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
talk about how you did get into FAIR. Obviously there's like, it's been what, like almost, I think a year and a half now since it was sort of officially made into a project. Aspire Press launched maybe a little bit earlier than FAIR was announced as a named thing. What attracted to you about to that project? And like, obviously you're like it's the interesting problem solving stuff about this thing that is interesting to you. What interesting problems did you see about the project that you wanted to help try to solve?
Risk management. So as of, you know, late September 2024, we noticed a risk in the supply chain for WordPress software. It was very concerning because we've got a lot of clients that we've done work for, and a lot of them it's just a basic website or whatever. It's, even if it's e-commerce, it's not a huge, you know, Amazon's not banging down our door for work. They're small shops, right? So rebuilding those, or, you know, if worst case, if we had to, not a big deal, but we'd built applications on it for clients. So we were using WordPress as an application framework for a number of these things that have some fairly complex, and in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if things go really south for WordPress and for this distribution, and because the future at that point was really uncertain, what happens if a client comes back and says, you gave me bad advice and I trusted you as a professional? You're a professional consultant, you've got all the experience, and you told me to do this thing, and now I'm subject to this kind of thing just happening. And so I kind of, it's the point I thought I had to get involved and do something. So if you recall, around that time, there was a lot of blog posts and, you know, social media posts, you know, here it is on GitHub. This is how you host your own version of the WordPress repository. And I thought, well, gee, that's great, but it doesn't help anybody, because that's, you know, was everybody going to do that? No, that doesn't. So I started looking around, and I found Aspire Press, which Sarah Savage had started like October 2024. So it was like right after. And it was a vision for distributed, federated software repositories. So I hopped into the community there, and I found it was a community, not a guy with a GitHub thing. It was a community of people, and they were asking the right questions, which I've always thought asking the right questions is important, is more important than giving the right answers. Because you know, if you're asking the right questions, you will get there. And that's kind of what I found with this group. And so started working with them, ended up managing the project. And then as FAIR was forming, like right around Christmas 2024 and January 25, there were a few of us that were working with Aspire Press, you know, Andy Fragan and others that are that would be well known in the WordPress community, kind of drifted into the FAIR conversation. Drifted. It was a little more, it was not so much drifting, it was pretty direct. So and I got involved at that point as well with FAIR, because Aspire Press had had a working piece that FAIR was going to need, and you know, that comes about a little bit later. But by the time FAIR was forming, Aspire Cloud was already in beta, and we were testing. So so Aspire Cloud is the basically the server piece that is, it's an API server that that tells you, okay, if you need to update this piece of WordPress software, this plugin, here's where you get the download. And the download comes from a mirror, which was the other difference about AspirePress, is rather than just saying, here's the code, go set up your own thing, it was, we're going to make a public mirror that everybody can access. And then we're going to, you know, federate it so that there would be not just one mirror, they can be all kinds of. So so that was the piece that we had in beta. So we'd replicated enough of the WordPress API to serve packages and rewrite the download URL to the mirror. So so as FAIR was coming together, and this was like spring 2025, so officially announced June, I think it was 6th. And so it was just a few months of writing the protocol and figuring out what the FAIR governance model would be and, you know, shipping the plugin. So we had a AspirePress version of what became the FAIR plugin, but it was a little more rudimentary. It didn't do all of the functions that the FAIR plugin, or what we're now calling FAIR Connect, what it does, because it stops all of the phoning home, if you want. So it's not always pinging .org for everything, like browser
app, and, yeah.
Yeah, all of that stuff that on a principle level, I don't want to do that for performance reasons, but also privacy and like, you know, all the reasons, right? Anyway, so FAIR was able to, you know, ship that plugin, and we announced this, we had already arranged to do a an announcement of Aspire, a demo of Aspire Cloud at the event in Basel, the Alt Control Org, and FAIR was ready for the same. So we tag teamed, through the summer, then we brought all of the AspirePress pieces that were, you know, that were FAIR related. We brought them all into FAIR. So in addition to Aspire Cloud, there was Aspire Explorer, which is the browser part that you just browse the repo on fair.pm. And that it's a WordPress plugin that adds those pages and then uses the API to get the listings of all the things from Aspire Cloud. And then most of those got renamed, but the Aspire Cloud decided to keep the name just as an homage to what Sarah had founded and started. So so we had, you know, we had a good 6 month head start on building Aspire Cloud so that it was ready when FAIR officially announced. So
I think one of the things that I think is interesting about, especially coming from sort of full circle from the conversation of Linux and open source software, that is maybe not discussed a lot in connection with FAIR specifically, because a lot of people just perceive FAIR to be a WordPress specific thing. But what's interesting about FAIR is that it is really about package management and package distribution. And in open source broadly, and this is sort of to your point about people inside the WordPress community looking outside of WordPress, that's not a new concept. Like, the concept of package management and distribution, and even maybe federated distribution, is not unique in open source. Like, these, there are models for this that you could use and base the underpinnings of FAIR on top of and build on top of, again, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just, you know, thinking the it's a Web 3 model, but I'll come to that. So that I talked about the supply chain at WordCamp Canada in November, and and the WordPress supply chain is very different from what you would design today, from the traditional or supply chains are getting a lot of attention right now, as they need, because they're vulnerable. And I think that FAIR actually has the potential to become the gold standard for software supply chains, because its architecture is for now. It's not something that we've inherited. It's not something that we've tried to piece together and just sort of iterate on to make it almost acceptable. It's something that was designed from the ground up. And the interesting thing about it is that, and this is my pulling threads thing, is when you look at all of the pieces on their own, all of it has been done before.
Yeah.
Everything's been done before. So it's all proven. Just nobody's put it together this way. So it's all the Lego bricks that you can imagine, and they're all proven, but nobody's seen this thing before that we pieced together with it. And I think that's part of the real genius in it. So Ryan McHugh did a great job on the drafting the first version of the FAIR protocol, and we've been extending it as needed, because it was designed to just address basically digital goods. So it's not a WordPress thing, and there's a lot of misconception here, because if Yoast isn't involved anymore, it's no longer WordPress, it's dead, it's whatever. None of that's true. It's ongoing. And just a couple of weeks ago in Germany, we added Typo3 support. So now the Typo3, as of the version 14 that's coming out next week, it will support FAIR in core. So you'll be able to do your software updates using FAIR rather than using their legacy, we call it TER, T-E-R, Typo3 extension repository. And they also have composer support, but you'll be able to use FAIR. So they saw the value in it. I worked with some of their security people, and they say, what about this? And what about, and I'm going, that's the right question. And we talked through how it worked, and I get a genuine feel of moving from skepticism to enthusiastic support, as he sort of basically vetted the model, which was also actually vetted by some of the web hosts who didn't want to be named, but they did security reviews and audits on it, and they gave us feedback, and we made, thankfully nothing had to be huge, but we made some changes that said, okay, well, this could be better. Let's make it better. And that's what we need to get into the future. But FAIR can be, I keep saying, if you've got a group of science fiction writers that just want to share all of their EPUBs, you know what? FAIR will do that. It'll do that, because it's at the protocol level. It's nothing to do with WordPress. It's about the supply chain. And then, in fact, the very original design of it, all of the WordPress specific pieces are extensions to the protocol. They're not baked into the core of it. And it's designed that way so that so now that we have Typo3, the Typo3 comes in as protocol extensions that are sort of designed exactly the same way. And it's a good model.
Well, thank you very much, Brent, for coming on. Thank you, everyone, for watching or listening to this in the future. Brent, before we go, is there, if somebody wanted to find you on the internet, where would they find you?
Todorash.net. It'll link you to wherever I am on socials and all of that. So,
awesome. Well, thanks again, Brent. And again, thank you, everyone. And we'll see you on the internet.